Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Janice Zundi from Atlanta about giving and receiving life through kidney transplants, one woman's remarkable story of health and healing. I am so looking forward to hearing her story.
I am too. A remarkable story. Looking forward to that. But first, Adam, we've got some research that matters, and we've also got our weekend warrior, Dr. Tim Taft, today.
Yeah, we're going to hear about some common sports injuries that, unfortunately, probably most of them have happened to me. And we're also going to talk about do people work too long, and are certain types of foods actually addictive when we even think about them? What's our very first research that matters?
The first one answers the question, can hard work kill you? What do you think, Adam?
If
that's the case, we're in trouble.
are we alive?
Yeah, I know.
You know, Christy, I've just finished working about 80 hours to 90 hours a week the last 2 weeks on working, taking care of our inpatients on the hospital wards. Very, very tough, demanding work.
Really tough work.
What did this research show?
Well, this research really looked at people who work more than 11 hours a day.
Uh-oh.
I know. They looked at 7,100 British workers over 11 years and tracked how many hours of day they worked and various things that happened to their health, and discovered that working more than 11 hours a day increased the risk of heart disease by 67% compared with people who worked 7 or 8 hours a day.
That's not good.
Not good at all. This was not reassuring for me to read.
No, and this was actually in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And, you know, they were looking at other things that could cause heart disease in these people, including their diet, the amount of exercise, their blood pressure, their cholesterol levels, and I assume smoking habits. So I assume that they controlled for all these things and still found that people who worked the 11 hours a day had higher rates of heart disease.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the take-home message as I see this, there's more research that should be done. But for people who need to work long hours, for whatever reason, many of us do work long hours, but that we should take special attention to be sure we're exercising, be sure we're getting good control of our blood pressure, talking to our doctors about our risk of heart disease. And if we can cut back on work, that's probably a reasonable thing to do.
Well,
it's,
you know,
just
the
not
new work hour
for lots of people.
No, you're right. And the new work hour reforms for our residents actually suggest that there is a limit to how much you should be working. And then also, I would say vacation time. I don't think we take enough vacation time here. And maybe we'll talk about this another time on vacation.
That sounds great, Adam.
Well, we need to work less, maybe a little more vacation time. And what about the type of food? What's this next research that matters?
Well, this is also, I mean, just as heart disease is so common in our country, we know obesity is a really important problem, one of our biggest health challenges in our country. And this is looking at what happens to the brain when young women are tempted by an exciting, tasty treat.
Yeah, this was in the Archives of General Psychiatry, and they did what's called a functional magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, as it's known to most people. And they looked at the brain activity in almost 50 women, but some who were thin and some who were overweight. And they offered them a chocolate milkshake, yummy, or a tasteless solution. Doesn't sound too tasty.
They did, and they looked on the MRIs to see what parts of the brain kind of lit up, and they found that the ones who saw the milkshake, it triggered a certain activity in the brain that is similar to the types of the part of the brain that lights up for people who are addicted to drugs or addicted to other substances.
Yeah, and, you know, this is intriguing because it does suggest that just these visual cues really do trigger people's urges. And we've known this in the smoking world actually for quite a long time, that, you know, the thinking about smoking, watching a movie of someone smoking triggers that. So it doesn't surprise me, Christy, that, you know, seeing a cue here for something pleasurable and tasty triggers this in people who maybe have problems with weight issues. This could be a real issue.
Well, and it highlights the role of or implicates, I guess, the role of advertising and pictures of food and pictures of perhaps unhealthy options that get us, you know, excited or craving those things. That works for the marketing company and for the advertising world, but maybe that's part of what's going on in our country.
Yeah, I do think I would take
say
exception.
One small piece
yeah, no,
of that.
One exception is just that they did suggest here that maybe we should have altered the cues, maybe like removing billboards of foods. And I'm not so certain I would agree going to that extreme. But I do think let's work with people. Let's help maybe separate out the desire for something and the actual behavior.
Absolutely.
Well, we have time now to listen to our weekend warrior, Dr. Tim Taft, about some common injuries that happen to a lot of people. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Taft.
Well, it's exciting to be back with you again.
Well, what kind of a story do you have for us today? You mentioned, I think, then that you had wanted to talk a little bit about back pain in kids.
Yeah, back pain in kids isn't all that common, but when it does occur, it can be very frustrating to deal with. Adolescents, particularly those that take part in gymnastics and diving, will often have back pain that's associated with a problem called a pars defect. The pars is a part of the spine, and they get a little stress fracture through this, and it can be an ongoing, frustrating, difficult problem to deal with, especially in a young, active youngster.
So we're talking about a pars defect. That's P-A-R-S, correct?
Right, and
people,
if you want to
Google
we can
it?
Add the intra-articularis into that, but that gets more complex.
I don't know, but you said a little stress fracture of the spine.
That sounds like a break to the
that
spine.
Sounds like, that sounds like the dentist telling me, it's just a little small needle, it won't hurt.
That's right. It's, you know, the but a part of the back is a little weaker than the adjacent areas, and with repetitive hyperextension,
so that's the gymnast,
which we often see in the gymnasts or in the divers when they hit the water, or in offensive linemen and in football when they come up and they arch their back. Doing this repetitively will cause problems with the pars region of the lumbar spine.
I saw a friend of ours had a tennis player, a really elite tennis player. I can imagine the same sort of whipping motion in the serve could put a pretty significant stress in that same region.
Sure. It can occur in a lot of people, but the place that we customarily see it are in the people that do the hyperextension, and the really good tennis players will often hyperextend their back a lot during the serve.
So this shows up as pain sometimes in teenagers was the example, but what do you do? How can you help them?
Well, it shows up as pain, and the thing that when you're doing your physical examination that is fairly characteristic of this is that if you have them stand and lean backwards, that causes a lot of aggravation of the problem. These patients characteristically have very tight hamstrings. And so one of the things that we want to do is to start them on a physical therapy program to work on core stretching, core strengthening, and hamstring stretching emphasis. And in the early stages, that program is usually sufficient. If that fails, then you have to get them to stop doing their activity until they recover, and sometimes bracing is necessary.
And what about, is it a clinical diagnosis, plain x-rays, MRI, what do you need to do?
It's a clinical diagnosis that is supported by x-rays. There is a characteristic finding on the plain x-rays that confirms the diagnosis, and in the early stages, you may not see the plain film changes and an MRI or a so-called SPECT scan or bone scan is helpful to make the diagnosis.
And for these teenage athletes, the gymnast or the diver or the swimmer, can they keep at their sport or do they need to rest from their sport?
We generally try to manage them symptomatically. And if they can continue their sport without having too much pain, we think it is all right for them to continue. But if they have enough discomfort that it's beginning to interfere with their practice schedule, their performance ability, then we've got to back them off.
So it sounds like a not an easy diagnosis necessarily always to make, and not an easy diagnosis necessarily to treat, but one that has to be done with an expert like yourself, physical therapist, a team approach.
That's certainly true, and it's often very frustrating because it frequently takes longer to recover than the athletes and their parents wanted to.
Well, we appreciate you letting us know. It's this is something we hear a fair amount about, and I know a lot of listeners probably know a lot of people who have it or at least have some low back pain. They should at least think about it. So thanks so much.
Well, I've enjoyed being with you again.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Taft. Well, that concludes our first segment of our show. We've had time to talk about some research that matters about foods triggering parts of the brain, about working long hours and that being related to heart disease.
And really trying to rehab after common sports injury.
So we are going to take a break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Janice Zundy about giving and receiving life through kidney transplants. This is one woman's remarkable story of health and healing. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we are about to have a conversation with kidney transplant survivor Janice Zundy about her remarkable story of health and healing.
Janice, thanks so much for being with us today on Your Health.
Sure.
You know, I think Christy and I realize that in the 2+ years that we've had this show, we've heard some remarkable stories, we've talked with remarkable providers, but I don't think we've really talked much about this whole issue of transplants, and in your case, kidney transplants, and the incredible changes that have occurred that your story really helps our listeners understand a little bit more about. Can you tell us a little bit about you and your experience initially with what caused you to need a kidney transplant?
I am a juvenile diabetic. I was diagnosed with juvenile diabetes at 7 years old, and after my daughter was born, when I was 30, my kidneys started failing, and that's essentially what caused the kidney failure. And my first transplant was a kidney pancreas. It was a double transplant.
And that was back in 1995, I understand?
Right. That was in 95.
And you received a kidney and a pancreas, and was that from a relative, or what was the process
there?
No.
In order to receive a pancreas, it has to be from a deceased donor.
Sure.
So I received both organs from the same donor.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know today, you know, that hasn't been that long ago, but back in 1995, I don't think, as I was starting my medical training, to hear someone having both a kidney and a pancreas transplant, I would have considered that a pretty major and a pretty unusual at that time operation to be having both at the same time, and a very large operation. Was it?
It was a very large operation. The surgery took about 9 hours. And when I had it done, it was still somewhat experimental. It was right at the beginning of the kidney pancreas, the double transplant program. And the physician who did the actual surgery, it was the person who started that whole kidney pancreas program. He's Dr. David Sutherland in Minnesota. And I was very, very fortunate to have him as my surgeon. And the pancreas is still functioning today.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to ask, what were the expectations at that time about how long the kidney and the pancreas would last for you? My understanding is when you get a transplant from a deceased donor, that there is only a certain number of years that it's expected to continue to work.
You know, it's hard to say. I have friends who had the same surgery around about the same time as I did, and they have both kidney and pancreas functioning to date. So it's really hard to say. I think you know, so many things can go wrong, but I would say anywhere from, you know, 10 to 15, 20 years from a deceased donor.
And you were 30 years old at this time.
I was 30.
Wow.
Well, I know we're talking with Janice Zundi about her remarkable story of health and healing and her kidney pancreas transplant at a very young age. And before we jump forward a little bit, Janice, because the story really, if that were only we heard, it would still be remarkable, but there's so many turns and twists. But how did having that surgery change the quality of your life?
Well, I need to just go back. I was 30 when I had my daughter. I was 37 when I had the kidney pancreas.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was on insulin shots from 7 years old. And really, you know, people say, wow, you know, not to have shots, that's incredible. To be honest, the shots are the least of it. It's the long-term complications that really... that you really benefit from. I mean, of course, it's, you know, great that I don't have to check my blood sugar, you know, 10, 15 times a day like I used to. And it's great that I don't have to give the shot. But to me, the fact that, you know, the long-term complications are, I wouldn't say prevented, but that, you know, it helps.
Much less of the problems that we might associate with unchecked diabetes with
right.
the eyes and the nerves and all of the vascular or blood complications.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Nice.
And, of course, you know, just dealing with, you know, high and low blood sugars is a trial in itself. So, of course, you know, that's just great that I don't have to worry about that.
And so since receiving the pancreas and the kidney then, at least dealing with your lack of insulin and the problems you were having before with your diabetes are essentially gone or improved, but you've had some other things to deal with.
Well, yeah, you know, because, you know, I'm on a lot more medications that have their own side effects, but... You know, when you weigh it up, it's, in the long term, it's just my life has been so much improved. I have a life, you know, whereas it might not have been the case otherwise.
Well, let's jump forward a few years because I think there's perhaps a mistaken notion that even myself as a physician for many years would say, okay, the story is over. You're going to have 20 years of uninterrupted health. But it didn't work out that way because... Shortly after some surgery to help correct some problems from the pancreas, in 2007, you found yourself facing once again serious kidney problems.
That's correct. After an enteric conversion.
Which is trying to take the pancreas that's not... emptying or causing problems the way it had to empty after the surgery the first time and correct that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So because of some of the medications, actually, the one immunosuppressant drug, Prograf, it caused a lot of toxicity in the kidney. It was a buildup of toxicity over the years. The kidney failed. And for the first time, I had to go on dialysis. And dialysis is, out of everything that I've had to deal with, I would say dialysis is the hardest thing.
And so for people who may not know about dialysis, this is where you go in 3 days a week usually and have basically your blood is purified in a way that the kidney normally would do it. Is that
right.
How you explain it to people?
Yeah, that's correct. That's exactly what it does. It does it, over, you know, it depends. Everyone's different, but usually it's about 3 hours and... There's some clinics where you can go in and have it done very, very slowly overnight, and that apparently is the trend in Europe to do it more regularly.
But you said it was exciting. You said it was really hard for you. What was the hardest thing about dialysis, or one of the hard things for you?
Well, first of all, before you even get started, I was already feeling so sick, you know, just from, you know, a very high creatinine level and all the toxins in my body because the kidneys weren't flushing them out. So by the time the actual treatment came along, I was just very ready for it. And then once the dialysis needles are placed, they're put into place, it's always kind of, you know, if you pull too much liquid, my muscles would contract and it would be very painful, and often I would get sick. It was just a very, very tough, long process.
Well, gosh, Janice, we want to hear more about your story and to hear more about the process that led to another kidney transplant. And we do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Janice Sundy, about her remarkable story of health and healing. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Janice Sundy about giving and receiving life through kidney transplants. And Janice, right before the break, you had your original kidney transplant, and then 12 years later, you were on dialysis, and obviously the search for a new kidney was beginning. Tell us a little bit about that search for a new kidney. It sounded like just that this was a roller coaster.
Well, straight after the surgery, the conversion that I had in Minnesota, my husband immediately, you know, went and got tested, had his blood tested and his tissue typing done to see whether he was a match, and he was not a match. So that was pretty devastating to both of us. And once we came home, we immediately just, you know, got on that train just to try and find a match. And we registered with several hospitals, the second hospital being Emory Hospital, which is close to where we live and where I had received all my care for the last few years. So, you know, we immediately did that. And every time you register with a hospital, they have their own set of tests and stipulations, and so you go through very rigorous testing, and it takes a few days, and it's very emotionally and physically draining.
And so you, as the patient, have to navigate this, have to find out what list to get on, how to get on them, how to go get all these tests done?
Well, once you register with the hospital, they tell you, you know, what their protocol is, and you pretty much go to their hospital for most of the tests.
But you're registering with more than one hospital.
Right.
There's time and expense and
exactly.
and mental exhaustion, I'm sure, in addition to all the other issues. And then on top of this, while you're hoping to immediately try to get another transplant and get off dialysis, you came down with an unfortunate new diagnosis.
While I was, you know, going through this whole process, I was just getting increasingly sick, and I developed PTLD, which is proliferative lymphoma related to the transplant.
Because you're on immunosuppressive drugs and your immune system suppressed, you developed a lymphoma that would probably, for a while, take you right back off that transplant list.
It did. I immediately had to get off the list and have 4 weeks of Rituxan treatment.
Chemotherapy.
And, yeah, it was, you know, very such a disappointment to me to get off the list and to have to really, you know, have this diversion. Because it took a long time for me to actually get back on the list. And in some hospitals where we had registered, I never did get back on the list. They just refused to relist me and consider me as a candidate for transplant.
How did you hold on to hope? I mean, that I cannot imagine having gone through that whole process to get a kidney and then coming down with another new big diagnosis that then took that hope of getting a new kidney away.
All I can say is thank God for my husband because he was my cheerleader and my advocate, and he was relentless. He was absolutely relentless.
You're talking about Steve,
my
right?
My husband, yeah, Steve. Because honestly, when you're as sick as I was, you just don't have the emotional and physical energy to deal with this. And he was calling and, you know, contacting the hospital where we'd listed every week, you know, is there a kidney? The one hospital, which I won't mention, mixed up his labs and my labs and had him mentioned as the donor and the recipient.
Oh. I mean, yeah.
You know, hospitals really make mistakes and you have to be on top of them. And he was that person that was doing this for me and just kept me hoping that it was eventually going to happen.
Well, I know that you had a relative that and that you had these trials with different hospitals where you might be on the list and then off the list because of this new diagnosis. But then a relative told you about Johns Hopkins and that there was this kind of a daisy chain kidney transplant program that you and Steve might be eligible for. Tell us a little bit about that.
We had thought about registering with Hopkins and, you know, just kind of ran out of energy at one point. And then, you know, someone raised this, you know, raised Hopkins again. So we recontacted them and sent them all our labs and all our information. And they just picked it up and were right on top of it.
Meaning that you could qualify with a qualified donor, but then your Steve, your husband, would also make a donation of a kidney to a different third donor. Recipient, so that both of you would get kidney. He would have a kidney that he'd be taken, and you'd be given a kidney at the same time.
That's right.
Very novel approach to kidney transplants.
Well, it's called paired donation, and what it does is it really gives hope to people who are really losing hope of ever finding a kidney and, you know, being healthy again, and really saving your life. And it was started by a guy by the name of Mike Reese in Toledo, Ohio. And he started the whole paired donation program. And many, many people have been transplanted because of this. So there's nothing signed. It's just an unspoken
agreement.
Right, agreement that, you know, you will go through with this. And because, of course, if one person reneges on it, the whole thing falls apart.
So the idea is, I mean, typically someone looks for someone in their family who has the right match to be able to give you an organ. But if you can't find someone, this is an opportunity where if you find someone who's willing to be generous and give to someone they don't know, that in return you're going to be able, and in this case you were able, to
right.
receive a kidney. That's remarkable.
It is remarkable, and all I can say is thank God for this because it saved my life.
And you had another kidney transplant in 2008.
That's right.
And tell us, how have you done since then? What have you learned? What can you share with our listeners?
What can I learn? You know, when you're sick, all you want to be is healthy, and you think that all the unimportant things in life will just never, you know, you'll never have to deal with things like that because you've really touched rock bottom. And then, you know, you get healthy and you want what everybody else wants. You know, you want to enjoy life but I have learned to value what I have and to value my relationship with my husband and my daughter and just to enjoy every day.
Wow, that's an incredible blessing.
It sure is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we appreciate, Janice, you sharing just a small snippet of a story that is remarkable. I know for our listeners that we will have a little bit more time to talk with Janice that you can listen to on our website to hear a little bit more about this remarkable story. But thank you so much for just reaching out and sharing something that I think is an inspiration, not only to Christy and I, but to listeners and other healthcare providers.
It's my pleasure. I hope that if there's anyone out there in need of a kidney, that it gives them some hope and some ideas of what to do.
Thank you so much, Janice. We've been talking with Janice Zundy about giving and receiving life through kidney transplants. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns, and we're also going to take some time with our coast-to-coast correspondent, Dr. Peter Curtis.
Yeah, it'll be great to have him back. You also, as a listener, can send your questions and comments to yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081 or send us a question right now on Twitter, and we'll answer it on an upcoming show. Well, we have an interesting a house call today. Christy, what's our very first one?
Well, let's listen to it.
I'm a tennis player, and I've been getting injured a lot, small little strains. What is the proper way to stretch? Do you stretch before or after or what?
Tennis player. Well, I like that.
I knew you'd like this one, Adam.
I love tennis players. You tennis players out there, send us your questions. Send us your experiences.
Adam is a great tennis player. Oh, I am just starting to get back into it.
I love it. I wouldn't say great, but I do like it.
So I bet you're
it's
good.
It's fun there. And I do get injured a lot. So I can relate to our listener here about the, I wouldn't even call them small little strains. I'd call them ouches and bangs, and boy, my muscles are sore when I haven't played in a long time and I go out there and really try to play hard.
Well, and it's a real common question about stretching because we were taught growing up at PE class and in school that you really should stretch and cool down before and after exercise. That's pretty conventional, common wisdom, right?
Yeah, and I've seen research, though, that goes both directions on this, Christy, that say some of it says that the old way was you should, but then some new research has said, well, it really doesn't matter so much. I don't know if I really believe the newer stuff.
Yeah, well, I looked.
What do you think?
I looked, and there was a systematic review where they take a bunch of studies and look at them together and found
that's what
that,
I called systematic.
Yes, and that was a five different studies finding that doing stretching exercises before exercise didn't reduce muscle soreness, did not reduce the risk of injury. There was another systematic review that was done and showing that it also didn't decrease soreness after working out. But most people say, well, there's not a downside to warm up. So doing a little bit to get your blood flowing sort of makes sense to kind of ease into it versus just going out there and playing a really tough match.
Yeah, and I think it's a difference if you're going out there and you're going to go running and you can jog slow to start with versus tennis where you have this, you know, big start and stop area here. But I personally, and this is the heuristic of a physician who plays tennis, I think it's a great idea to do a few minutes of stretching before and afterwards, if no other reason, to get your mind in the right place.
But we can't say scientifically that there's proof that a certain warm-up exercise or certain stretches will decrease the chance that you do get injured when playing tennis. So, you know, make sure you wear proper footwear. We both think it's a good idea to stretch and warm up a little bit and do what you can to take care of yourself.
Okay, let's listen to our very next house call.
Is it bad to sit in front of a computer screen in a dark room, or should I turn the lights on?
Well,
yes, it's bad to sit in front of a computer in a dark room.
I do this a lot, so I saw this and was like, ooh, I probably...
Is this you, Christy?
No, I did not ask this question, but thank you for the listener who did. And, you know, it's more and more as we are more dependent on our computers, there's more coming out about computer eye strain, about problems related to being on the computer a lot, and being in the dark... with a really bright computer is one thing that
unless your computer is the size of the big screen TV in the room, I think, you know, if you're in a dark room, you should either be sleeping or watching TV or a movie. I don't think you should be on that computer in the dark room. That's my own personal. I don't know if there's any research on this.
Well, I mean, there are in the eye vision world, there is something now called computer vision syndrome, where people get eye strain and headaches, blurred vision, neck and shoulder pain, and from being on the computer a lot. And one of the recommendations is not to sit in the dark because of the kind of strain it causes on your eyes, and you've got this real bright thing and then darkness all around. And other recommendations are like sit up, you know, be in a proper chair, have the screen in front of your eyes instead of like looking down or having awkward positions of your neck to be doing your work.
Well, speaking of neck, we have our coast-to-coast correspondent, and I've already heard that, unfortunately, he might have a story to tell us about some neck problems.
Peter, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure again.
It's been a while, Peter, since we talked with you, but it sounds you sound crystal clear, but we understand that things aren't all okay, perfectly okay, in the Curtis family today. What's going on?
Well, strangely enough, we had a day of sunshine yesterday.
Oh, so well that would be that would be rare, but probably not. That wouldn't get you back to visiting with us.
So the road dried off, and then it started raining this morning, and I suppose it made the road a bit slick. And my wife got rear-ended by another lady this morning.
That's not good.
On her way to the doctor.
Oh, on her way to the doctor, yeah. Someone crashed into her car from behind?
Yeah.
So Carolyn was on her way to the doctor. The other woman was?
No, Carolyn was on her way to the doctor.
Well, she probably got to go to the doctor after all, but not the way she thought, maybe.
So it was very convenient to be rear-ended just before you went to see the doctor.
How is she?
Because then the doctor could check your neck.
Is she doing okay?
So that was good. But now she's resting with a heating pad and a stiff neck. And I'm thinking about how well she's going to recover since I've been interested in whiplash injuries for many years.
Well, is that what you think she either has or will have?
Well, it's clear she had a whiplash because she said her head jerked forward. And, you know, there's what's called a contre coup. You know, you get the head jerks forward, then it comes back.
Contre coup.
And that usually produces, the contre coup being a French word meaning against blow. So the head of the neck goes backwards and flicks backwards and forwards. And usually you get some small bleeding that goes on in the muscles and the soft tissues around the upper part of the neck. And that produces edema, and then there's sort of a spasm. And
swelling in the neck and spasm of the neck.
From there.
Wow, that sounds difficult. You know, I actually had an injury like that a number of years ago, so I can relate to Carolyn, your wife, well. It's painful to start with, but what surprised me is the pain that continued.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that whiplash at very high velocity, let's say 60 miles an hour, is often produces less after effects than at about 20 miles an hour.
Really? So it's worse on your neck when you're not going as fast?
And I think the reason is that people who are hit at low speeds are not really paying attention. You know, they're in traffic in a city. They're not paying attention. They're not aware of what's going on in front of them. Hmm. So the after effects of whiplash at low rates seem to be more persistent than the one.
Like what? What kind of things do people have to deal with over a period of weeks to months?
Well, usually most people will recover, about 40% recover after about 3 months, and about 10% will have persistent symptoms.
Like?
Stiff neck, headaches, sometimes double vision or hearing problems.
And so what
sometimes their concentration is affected.
Oh, so what are the best things to do? What did the doctor tell your wife, and what are you telling her?
And hopefully they're the same thing.
The first thing is to relieve the pain. The other thing is not to sort of try not to wear a collar permanent, you know, day in, day out, because it's going to produce some local fibrosis with the healing, the blood healing around the muscles.
Wait, explain
so
that.
Gentle motion and exercise.
Is she but to wear a collar for a couple days or no?
Yeah, I mean as long as it's
a neck collar, one of those soft, flexible neck collars that kind of keeps your neck aligned.
But regular exercise about every hour or so is a good idea, because that actually helps to get rid of the edema.
So keep it moving.
Rotating, you know. Movements of the head, rotating, sideways, side bending, things like that. Even though it may be slightly painful, it's better to do that than just keep it stiff and unmoving.
So it sounds like that she will have a few weeks now of needing to do some rehabilitation. Well, we certainly want to wish Carolyn well, and it's good that she's with an expert, but I hope you'll be a husband and a doctor. We know you will, but please give her our wishes for a speedy recovery, though we know it may take some time.
Yeah.
Hope she's feeling better soon. Thank you for sharing some tips for our listeners.
And we'll look forward to maybe hoping to hear that she's doing much better the next time we talk to you.
Okay.
Take care.
I think so.
We've been talking with our Coast to Coast correspondent, Dr. Peter Curtis. We'll look forward to talking with you again next time, Peter.
Good to talk to you. Bye.
Well, thanks for joining us today on Your Health. That'll conclude our house calls, and we appreciated having our conversation with Dr. Peter Curtis about his experience as our Coast to Coast correspondent. If you have any further things that you would like to let us know, you can actually go to yourhealthradio.org and let us have a message.
And we want you to call us at 919-966-8081, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, find us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook.
And iTunes. You can now get free podcasts on iTunes.
You guys can find us however you in so many different ways.
We are not going to be able to avoid it, but we'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Janice Zundi. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.